From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's World AIDS Day, and the UN AIDS program has just released the latest figures on the worldwide epidemic. On today's Fresh Air, we talked to Dr. Jonathan Mann about the epidemic's latest developments. Mann was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program. After investing 13 years and spending $1 billion, architect Richard Meyer is more than ready to attend the opening of the Getty Center later this month. We'll talk about designing this museum and cultural center, which has been described as a new castle of classical beauty. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews bass baritone Bryn Terfel's new CD of Handel arias. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. A 14-year-old freshman at a high school in western Kentucky opened fire before class today, killing one student and wounding several others. Lori Barrett with member station WKMS reports.
The students were taking part in a daily prayer circle at Heath High School when the alleged student gunman opened fire. A girl who was shot died a few hours later at Lourdes Hospital in Paducah. The seven others are being treated at area hospitals. Karen McChristian, a spokeswoman for the McCracken County School District, says the suspect, a male freshman, was arrested immediately after the shooting. The boy had reportedly bragged that he was going to do something big today. Classes have been dismissed for the day. For NPR News, I'm Lori Barrett in Murray, Kentucky.
Global warming talks got underway in Kyoto, Japan today. Negotiators at the UN conference must get over huge differences in their country's positions. The United States is suggesting there is room for compromise. NPR's Richard Harris reports from Kyoto.
The key to slowing global warming is to limit emission of the gases that contribute to the greenhouse effect. Delegates meeting in Kyoto don't agree about how deeply to make those cuts or how quickly. And there are other important issues that divide the negotiators. One dispute is over how much developing nations should do now, since countries like China and India will be the largest emitters of greenhouse gases in the coming century. Another is whether nations should be allowed to sell or trade the right to emit these gases. With these huge issues looming, meeting organizers are looking for any signs of compromise. So when the United States representative hinted that the U.S. would consider allowing different nations to have somewhat different goals, officials seized on that comment as an example of progress in this extremely difficult round of negotiations. Richard Harris, NPR News, Kyoto.
A new Swiss report finds that Swiss banks were the leading buyers of Nazi gold, but questions about what happened to the gold after World War II ended remain unanswered. From Bern, Imogene Folks reports.
The report shows that 76% of all gold from Germany went to Switzerland, $389 million worth at 1945 prices. Although most of the gold went to the Swiss National Bank, the report also reveals that Swiss commercial banks received $60 million worth of gold, over three times more than had been thought. And for the first time, details of how much gold the German Reichsbank took directly from individuals becomes clear, $146 million. But there's still no answer to the question of where the gold in Swiss banks went after the war. And with the International Gold Conference due to start in London on Tuesday, this report will not help Switzerland's image abroad. For NPR News, I'm Imogen Folks in Bern, Switzerland.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 122 points at 79.45. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, there is a rally on Wall Street, where the stock market is at its highest level in 7 weeks. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
The rally was sparked by evidence that economic growth remains moderate and inflation low. Nationwide manufacturing was weaker than expected during October, while raw material prices fell. The stock market is also being supported by strong gains in the major overseas equity markets. Regional banking shares are higher on news of a merger in that industry. Cleveland-based National City Corp is buying First of America Bancorp of Kalamazoo, Michigan for $7.1 billion in stock. On an otherwise up day, Warner Lambert has lost more than 15% on concern about the toxic side effects of the company's new diabetes drug, Rezolin. I'm Doug Krisner.
The government says construction spending rose 0.1% in October for the fourth consecutive gain. The Commerce Department also says such spending was up 0.4% in September. The October increase was led by a jump in residential construction. The construction of single-family homes was up more than 1% to an all-time high. World oil prices slipped today in the first trading since OPEC ministers increased the cartel's production limit by 10%. Some oil prices dropped by as much as 30 cents per barrel today in New York. OPEC ministers say they're not concerned. The cartel's official ceiling used to be 25 million barrels a day per country, but many countries ignored that and pumped nearly 28 million barrels daily. Analysts say with the new ceiling, countries will continue to break the quota, and they will pump more than the official limit. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 170 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today is World AIDS Day, a day for discussion, planning for the future, and remembering those whose lives were taken by the disease. My guest, Dr. Jonathan Mann, was one of the organizers of the first World AIDS Day in 1988. Dr. Mann is an epidemiologist. From 1986 to 1990, he was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS. He's also senior editor of the book AIDS in the World. He's been a professor at Harvard School of Public Health for 7 years. We asked Dr. Mann to talk with us about the current state of the AIDS epidemic and the latest developments in treating it. Let's start with the latest statistics on the epidemic spread released by the UN in its World AIDS Day report.
Well, the UN AIDS program, which is the joint and co-sponsored program that brings together six United Nations agencies together, has developed its latest figures, which basically show that the global epidemic in 1997 grew by about 14%. There were about 5.8 million new HIV infections around the world, which translates to about 16,000 people a day who became newly infected with HIV during 1997. There, in addition, were an estimated 2.3 million deaths in 1997. So the global epidemic is expanding, it's intensifying, and actually, one of the figures that I found most dramatic is that there are an estimated 30.6 million people living with HIV and AIDS in the world today. And that translates to 1 per 100 sexually active people 15 to 49 years old in the world. In other words, 1 out of every 100 sexually active 15 to 49-year-olds in the world is infected today and is living with HIV.
You say that the number of people with AIDS grew by 14% in 1997. How does that compare to last year? What was the rate of growth?
Well, the epidemic has been continuing to grow. The 14% is the total number of HIV-infected people in the world. It's growing at different rates in different places. For example, in the United States, there's actually, for the first time in 1996 and again in 97, some very good news, which is that in 1996, for the first time, the number of new AIDS cases declined compared to 1995, in other words, compared to the year before, by 6%, and the number of AIDS deaths in 1996 went down about 25% compared to 1995. So in some parts of the world, the United States being one, there has actually been a downturn in the number of new AIDS cases and particularly deaths. In other parts of the world, like sub-Saharan Africa, which is the most heavily affected part of the world, or in Southeast Asia, the epidemic is continuing to expand at a very rapid pace. So it's a very mixed picture throughout the world.
Any other ways you interpret these new statistics?
Well, I think that the most important thing is that about 99% of the new infections with HIV are occurring in the developing world. And when we talk, as I hope we will, about the impact of treatment, which is really the reason why AIDS cases and AIDS deaths have declined in the United States, when we talk about treatment and treatment availability, that fact of the vast majority of new infections occurring in the developing world, I think we'll have to keep that strongly in mind.
Are the patterns of how HIV is spreading different in the have and the have-not countries?
There are very many differences between the, as you say, the have and the have-not countries, between the industrialized world and the developing world. The basic modes of spread, of course, are still always fundamentally the same. Sexual contact, contact with blood. So in some industrialized countries, for example, like the United States, injecting drug use plays a very important role, as does sex between men who have sex with men. In other parts of the world, like sub-Saharan Africa, the epidemic, which is quite large, is being driven principally by heterosexual transmission. Another way of expressing that is that in sub-Saharan Africa, 50% of the infected people are women, whereas in North America, in Latin America, only about 20% of the infected people are women. So there are differences in the dominant route of spread, but the fundamental roots are the same.
What's your favorite hypothesis about why the percentage of people with AIDS who are women is so much higher in other countries than it is in the United States?
Well, I think it still comes back to the question of the dominant route of spread at a point in time. When AIDS first appeared in the United States, men who have sex with men accounted for the very large majority of all AIDS cases. The proportion of people acquiring AIDS heterosexually, which then, of course, will mean the proportion of women infected as well, has gradually been increasing. So there's been a steady upward turn. And in fact, despite those very, very impressive and positive statistics that I quoted for the United States in 1996 compared to 95, in that same period, the number of new AIDS cases among African-American heterosexual men and heterosexual women increased between 12 and 19%. So everywhere, what we see is that the route of spread will determine who will be infected. Those roots can evolve, as they have in the United States. So you could say, in sum, that the U.S. started as an epidemic that looks pretty much like an epidemic among gay men, and then evolved gradually into an epidemic that increasingly affects injecting drug users and heterosexual transmission. And by the way, I should mention that wherever you see heterosexual transmission, as in sub-Saharan Africa, you're going to see a lot of infected children. So in 1997, of the 5.8 million new HIV infections, there were about 600,000 children, or 1,600 children a day, becoming infected with HIV, mostly from spread of infection from the mother, infected mother, to the fetus or the newborn child.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jonathan Mann. Today is World AIDS Day. He's the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program and a professor of public health at Harvard University. Are we seeing any new emergent strains of the HIV virus?
I don't think we're seeing particularly new emergent strains, but we're learning more about what exists. And there, we've been able to see that there are different subtypes of the AIDS virus in different parts of the world. So in, for example, Thailand, the subtype that dominates among people who've acquired the infection sexually differs from the subtype among those who have acquired the infection through injecting drug use. Those may differ from the subtype in Latin America or in Africa or in North America. But I think that we can say that, you know, the virus doesn't show any clear signs of evolving in a large sense. But that, in a sense, that statement could, in a sense, conceal what happens at the more individual level. The new drugs that have become available, the so-called combination therapy that has produced such remarkable changes in the fate of HIV-infected people in the United States, basically reducing the rate of developing AIDS in among people who are HIV-infected, and for people who have AIDS, protecting them, and in many cases, leading to a dramatic clinical reversal. People who look very weak and very thin and are clearly extremely ill, who regain weight, regain a sense of well-being, and return to essentially a normal life. It's a truly remarkable occurrence that these drugs are now available. Now, when drugs like this become available, and particularly when they're widely used, and particularly because these drugs are so complicated in terms of their how many you take and when you take them, and whether you take them with food or between meals and so forth, as well as the use of these drugs occasionally for what could be called post-exposure prophylaxis. Someone has what they think might be a high-risk sexual contact. They then take some of these drugs for a short period of time. These are circumstances in which we can expect and anticipate resistance to the drugs to emerge. So at the individual level, there can be escape. There can be strains of the virus that evolve in response to the presence of the antiviral agents and that become resistant to the drugs that we have. This has not yet become a public health problem, but it is one we can anticipate.
Do we have any new insights into what happens to the virus when a person with HIV is taking these new combination therapies?
What we found is that in people whose plasma virus level drops to an undetectable level, which is a very small level, in other words, with modern techniques, we can detect a very small number of viruses in the blood. People with undetectable levels of virus, because they are taking this combination therapy, nevertheless, in some cells in their body, are harboring virus. In other words, it's hard to get to that virus. It's been difficult to detect it, but now it's been shown to exist. And so we can't really talk about cure at this point. We can only talk at this point about very, very remarkable suppression of the virus. Hopefully, over the long term, after years of suppression, it might be possible that eradication of the virus from an individual could occur. But that will be a race in time between the development of resistant strains and the duration of effect of the drug. We just don't have all the answers yet, but we really can't speak in a strict sense of cure.
So now it's as if viruses are hiding out in cells when somebody takes the combination therapy. And if they stop taking those drugs, then the cells would come out of hiding and start reproducing again?
This is what is currently thought. As you can understand, because these drugs and their use is relatively recent, we don't have all the answers yet. But I think what we can liken it to is when new drugs are developed against bacteria, for example, there's an immediate positive effect. People can indeed, and sometimes in the case of bacteria, be cured. People are very optimistic. And then there's another phase that follows, which is a phase where we realize some of the limitations of the drug, some of the problems, what will some of the side effects be with long-term use of the drug. There's a lot to be learned, but there's still a very good piece of news in all of this. We just wish that this was good news that could be applicable at a global level, which is really in some ways why there is so much more attention now being given to vaccine.
Vaccine. Let's get to the vaccine. Where are we?
Well, we're in a paradoxical place. This is a little hard to understand why we have not had more progress towards vaccine development. I say that because there have been over 30 phase 1 trials, that is, trials of candidate vaccines to determine that they are safe. There have only been 3 phase 2 trials, and there is no trial yet underway which would demonstrate whether or not a vaccine candidate is effective. I think the reason we haven't progressed further in all the time that's been, and energy and money that's been spent towards vaccine, in a sense, is that the vaccine development situation has been taken over by a pure scientific model. By that I mean that the basic scientists, the research scientists who've done wonderful things, are asking for all the answers to try to understand every little bit of how a vaccine candidate might work before they will give the green light to testing a vaccine in people. However, the history of vaccine development, from smallpox to measles to the new Lyme disease vaccine that will be coming out soon, all demonstrate that at a certain point in time, even though scientists may disagree, it's important to take something that is safe, to try it in people, to learn from that, and then return to the basic science and back and forth until the best vaccine is available. The people must remember that we still today don't understand how smallpox vaccine works in detail. If we waited for all that information, we'd still have smallpox instead of living in a world in which smallpox has been eradicated.
A few people have offered to basically be human guinea pigs for the testing of an AIDS vaccine. And this has, of course, sparked a big ethical debate about whether that's appropriate or not. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the vaccine that they are offering themselves to, they're offering to be tested with, is a live attenuated vaccine, which is so far at this point from being a vaccine that we could imagine being safe and available and ultimately made available, that I think their gesture, the courage of which I admire, because there's a long tradition of physicians putting themselves on the line for what they believe might work in terms of therapy and prevention. So I admire the gesture. I just wish that they chose a more appropriate product. That is to say that I wish that they were pushing for the trials of vaccines that we already have information about in terms of safety. To be injected with an attenuated or weakened strain of HIV raises very, very serious long-term questions of what would happen to that attenuated virus in a person. So I welcome the gesture, I admire the gesture, but I really think that it distracts, unfortunately, from the principal problem we have, which is that we have candidate vaccines ready to test, and yet we've not been able to move that next step forward. It is a failure of public health leadership, which is costing us not only in financial terms, but obviously in human terms around the world, because only an AIDS vaccine will be able to bring this epidemic under control.
My guest is epidemiologist Dr. Jonathan Mann. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today is World AIDS Day, and my guest is Dr. Jonathan Mann. He was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global AIDS Program. He's a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. One of the concerns that you've been worried about for years is that in poor countries, people can't afford whatever treatments are available for AIDS. There's another controversy now about what's happening in poor countries, and this pertains to the testing of drugs there. Would you explain the controversy to us?
Yeah. When it was found that AZT could dramatically reduce the rate of spread of HIV from an infected pregnant woman to her newborn, the question arose whether a short course of the same drug would work in the developing world, because a short course would be much more affordable. The controversy arose when the short course of drug was compared with a placebo, that is, was compared with giving nothing, when, in fact, there is a preventive strategy available, which is the full course AZT as used in the industrialized world. This raised a number of very, very important issues about the relationship between industrialized and developing country researchers, their goals, the ethical questions involved, and so forth.
So, for instance, are we the wealthier country using the people in the poorer country as our guinea pigs?
Well, it wasn't so much in this case that we were using people as guinea pigs as that we were depriving them of a known effective treatment, even though that known effective treatment was in no way available and would not be available in that developing country. So it becomes a question of standard of care. When you are doing a trial in a developing country, should you use the local standard of care, which would have been no treatment at all, or do you use the best available global standard of care, which would be the treatment as used in the United States? So the implication was that perhaps researchers were behaving unethically and depriving women of a known effective treatment. And I think that the fundamental question really does get to the point of for whose benefit is the research being done, and also to take a public health perspective of the importance of learning this kind of information as rapidly as possible, because with 1,600 infants being infected each day principally in the developing world, we need a simple, effective, usable way to prevent those children from being infected.
I understand you were recently at an AIDS conference in Geneva in which you heard a lot of people who are from developing countries and who don't have access to the new drugs, can't afford the new drugs. What do they have to say?
Actually, I think this is a terribly difficult problem for us all. Because when we first confronted AIDS in the early and mid-1980s, we really were all in this same boat together. North, south, east, and west, we didn't have any drugs, we didn't have any treatment, we didn't have a vaccine, obviously. What we had was common sense, what we had was good public health, what we had was exchange of information, of ideas about how to prevent infection. And then in the midst of this equality, this solidarity in front of the disease, drugs became available that become available only to the rich. And then the poor see the rich getting the drugs and living, while they who are infected do not get the drugs and die. It is literally as stark as that. Now, what this does is bring forward once again the fundamental inequity that has existed always and continues to exist in many other areas. It exists in areas where preventable and treatable diseases go unprevented and untreated in the developing world simply for that fact of not having the money to buy the drug or pay for the drug. The fact, however, that in AIDS this has emerged in front of our very eyes, that it isn't an inherited inequity, it's an inequity that we've actually seen develop right in front of us, it's so difficult to be for industrialized country people to be excited as they deserve to be about the new drugs, and then to see the faces of those who will never get those drugs, who will not have those drugs, and who will die as a result. My hope here is that tension, that ethical dilemma, will push people not to deny it or look away from the problem, but to say to themselves, what can we do for the developing world? And I sincerely believe and feel that the answer to that lies in vaccine, lies in the need to emphasize, to put the energy and the resources, not into basic research on vaccine, but now into moving vaccines into the development phase so that they can become a reality. This, I think, will be the expression of global solidarity from an industrialized world that has drugs that treat to a world which needs desperately to prevent the over 95% of infections that are occurring in the developing world.
Dr. Jonathan Mann is a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews the CD we're listening to now, featuring Bryn Terfel performing Handel arias. Also, architect Richard Meyer tells us about designing the new Getty Museum and Cultural Center, which opens in Los Angeles this month. And we continue our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Mann on the global AIDS epidemic.
An army brave, a noble cause, a noble cause.
the cause of ham your zeal demands. A noble cause, the cause of ham your zeal demands. A noble cause, the cause of ham your zeal demands. Am I brave? Am I brave? A noble cause. Am I brave? A noble cause. The cause of ham your zeal demands. A noble cause. Am I brave? A noble.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with epidemiologist Dr. Jonathan Mann. Today is World AIDS Day. He was an organizer of the first World AIDS Day in 1988. From 1986 to 1990, he was the founding director of the World Health Organization's Global Program on AIDS. Dr. Mann is a professor at Harvard's School of Public Health. There's an interesting article in November in the New York Times basically asking the question, is it time to challenge the idea that AIDS is a special illness, that people with AIDS are entitled to kind of special benefits, whether it's free hot lunches, free haircuts, art classes, legal advice, dinners delivered. And these are all the special services that arose through a kind of informal AIDS network of people who were concerned about friends and loved ones and neighbors who had an illness, and the illness was such a frightening illness to people. A lot of people treated people with AIDS as if they were lepers. Now we know more about AIDS and so on, but this incredible network with these special support services has developed in the interim. So have you been following this debate?
Yeah, I have, and actually I think many of us for quite a long time have felt that AIDS is not special, but that we shouldn't respond to that idea by lowering standards of AIDS care back to the way it is for others, but rather use AIDS as an example of how what people need can actually be provided and how important that can be. I remember back in the late 1980s visiting San Francisco General Hospital, visiting the AIDS ward there, and being very impressed by all the amenities, the comfortable chairs, the plants, the VCR, the television, and so forth. And then going to the cancer ward fairly nearby, and the cancer ward was sort of a regular cancer ward, like you'd imagine. I think the response to that, again, is not to make the AIDS ward like the cancer ward, but make the cancer ward like the AIDS ward. And so I think that we really have learned a lot about the importance, for example, of dignity in the context of this epidemic. We've learned how critical it is that people who have a disease, no matter what disease or condition, be accorded dignity. And people with AIDS have fought for and demanded that dignity. Well, that same issue of dignity applies as much to people with cancer or heart disease or other conditions. So I think that it's a very healthy debate, and I think that the period of time when we saw AIDS as a completely unique phenomenon really ended some time ago. We now recognize that in this country, for example, if we really want to deal seriously with AIDS, we're not only going to have to deal seriously with issues of health care for all Americans, but we're going to have to deal with the factors in our society that make people vulnerable to HIV in the first place. And that includes racism as just one piece of that picture. Similarly, around the world, we're seeing that the underlying root causes of vulnerability to AIDS are the same conditions which create vulnerability to the other major causes of premature disability, illness, and death in the world. So I think we're at the verge of a reintegration, in a sense, of work against AIDS with broader work to improve health in this country and abroad.
What else are you thinking about on this World AIDS Day?
Well, I am first of all thinking of the first World AIDS Day in 1988, and how on that day, how exciting it was that in every single country in the world, there was activity among non-governmental organizations, among private people, around the issue of AIDS. The slogan for the first World AIDS Day was, "Tell the world what you're doing about AIDS." And I'll always remember the feeling in WHO headquarters as, in a sense, the countries around the world lit up one after another as we received reports of activities that people were using that day, that World AIDS Day, to really say something about the importance of AIDS and what they were doing and what needed to be done. Since then, World AIDS Day has remained a day that belongs to people, not to governments. It's not an official day that vanishes, you know, in the long list of official days. And even though there are official declarations and proclamations, the real heart of World AIDS Day has always been what people do on that day to think about AIDS, to remember those who have died, to think about how important it is to protect the living.
What is the theme of this World AIDS Day?
The theme of this World AIDS Day is children living in a world with AIDS. And I think that formulation is important because it concerns not only the 600,000 children newly infected in 1997. It doesn't only include the 1.1 million children who are living with HIV or AIDS this year. It also includes the rest of the world's children. We grew up, that is, those of us who are in our 40s and 50s, grew up in a world in which we grew up in a world without AIDS. Today's children grow up in a world that has this entirely new fact that is so important to their lives and to their behavior. I think it's really a very good thing that the UN AIDS program is focusing this year's attention as the major theme of World AIDS Day on the question of the children, children who are vulnerable to infection, children who are infected, and children who need to know and understand because this is now a world in which AIDS is a fact.
Well, Dr. Jonathan Mann, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Jonathan Mann is a professor at Harvard School of Public Health. In January, he will become dean of the New School of Public Health at Allegheny University of Health Sciences in Philadelphia. Coming up, architect Richard Meyer on designing the new Getty Museum and Cultural Center in Los Angeles. This is Fresh Air. The biggest and most expensive American cultural project since the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York opens this month in Los Angeles. The Getty Museum and Cultural Center sits on a 110-acre hilltop overlooking the city. It was described in a front-page article of today's New York Times as a stupendous new castle of classical beauty, a mountaintop temple where art's future worships its past. My guest is the chief architect, Richard Meyer, who is considered today's preeminent museum builder in America and Europe. The new center is a complex that houses the Getty Museum, photographic collection, research library, and more. Meyer has designed outdoor bridges and balconies connecting the separate spaces. I told him I thought it would be nice to step outside and clear your eyes before going back inside to look at more art.
Well, it is nice. And in fact, the museum is designed in such a way that you go inside and outside and back inside. And that's part of the museum experience, so that you explore a small section of the museum's collection. You go out, look at the views, look at the gardens, sit by the fountains, and then go back in. It's not a hermetically sealed experience the way in which many museums are. And what fascinates me is the way in which people use the outside spaces in a way that's not possible in other parts of the country because of the weather. We have outdoor meeting rooms, outdoor conference areas, outdoor sitting spaces, outdoor congregation spaces, plazas and courtyards and fountains, which people will sit around and just enjoy the views, the vistas, and being there.
Now, part of the exterior is travertine, a stone that you got from Italy. In fact, you had 14,000 tons shipped from Italy.
I thought it must have been pretty frightening to order 14,000 tons of stone and then wait for it to arrive.
We didn't order 14,000 tons all at once.
Oh, good.
It was over a number of years. But in thinking about the materials for the Getty Center, from the very beginning, it seemed appropriate that at least part of the center be constructed of stone, a material that has a sense of permanence, solidity, that in some ways anchors the building to the ground. And in searching for the right stone, the appropriate stone for the Getty, we looked at just about every stone quarry throughout the world. One day someone came in and said, "What about travertine?" And I said, "What I'm really interested in is a much rougher stone than what one sees with travertine." And so they said, "Well, you know, what if we could make it rough the way you want it?" And I said, "Well, that'd be great." And so we worked with the quarries in Italy to invent, as it were, a process by which the travertine is cut. And it's as though the big block of stone goes on a conveyor belt and a guillotine comes and clefts the stone. It drops on the stone and the stone cracks, as it were, according to its natural fissures. And in this way, we get a very rough finish, and each piece of stone is unique because it of the way in which the cutting takes place, and it's very rough, and it catches the light, and it's fabulous.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Meyer, the chief architect of the Getty Center, which opens in December. It opens to the public on December 16th. He's also written a book called Building the Getty. One of the things you are most famous for is your use of white exteriors, although you didn't use a white exterior at the Getty. So tell me first why you have so often used white exteriors in your buildings.
The whiteness of the surface seems to me to articulate most clearly the architectural ideas, the relationship between opacity and transparency, the relationship between open and closure, the relationship between linear elements and planar elements. But also the whiteness reflects all of the colors that exist in nature. It reflects the changing color of day. It reflects the changing color of the seasons. It reflects all the color that's around us every day. And in that way, it's full of color.
Now, you know, I was kind of brought up knowing that, like, a white rug and a white couch were really impractical because they would get schmutz all over them. And is it the same kind of problem with a building? If you have a white building in a smoggy city or any kind of urban environment, does it get dirty?
Well, I guess it depends on where it is. If it's in a schmutzy city, it's going to get dirty. But I think that most of the places which I've been able to build have a concern about the quality of air. And in Los Angeles or Atlanta, the quality of air is pretty good. And if you wash the building, when you wash the glass every now and then, it will stay clean.
Now, you didn't use a white exterior for the Getty.
That's right.
Why not?
Well, when I was selected as architect, it was written into law that the building couldn't be white. I didn't take that personally, of course.
But, oh, sure.
But it was felt that the whiteness of the building on the hill would be too glaring for some of the people.
Mm-hmm. Almost like a sun reflector.
That's right.
So I guess you got around that in part with the beige stone that you were using.
That's right. Stone and the beige panels met all the requirements of the neighborhood groups who were very vocal in the whole process.
So the beige stone is light, but it's non-reflective.
That's right.
While you were building the Getty Center, you were living in New York, but you had to obviously be in Los Angeles a good deal of the time. So you ended up moving into a house that I believe was adjacent to the site of the center. I guess this was an already existing house, but you describe it as having been infested with rats.
Well, when I moved into the house,
yeah.
It was all painted black inside. Of course, that didn't suit me very well.
Oh, that's right, Mr. White exterior. That's great.
So the first thing I did was, of course, have the entire interior painted white and got rid of all of the curtains and draperies and opened the house to the outside because it was such a great setting adjacent to the site where we're building. But I didn't renovate the house as such. It was really a cosmetic cleaning up that was done. And the previous owner who had lived there for perhaps 25 years had stuff all over. I mean, I've never seen a place more packed with electronic equipment and furniture and everything you can think of. But it was a house that was... how can I say, not terribly well tended over those 25 years. And in fact, there was a lot of animal life around. And there were snakes, there were coyotes, deer, and in fact, in the walls lived a number of family of rats.
How'd you deal with the rats?
Well, when I heard them crawling around at night, I would take a shoe and hit against the wall to try to get rid of them.
A little taste of Edgar Allan Poe in your home. Did you worry about getting bitten or anything?
No, I never saw one.
Oh, so just in the walls?
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Meyer. He's the chief architect of the new Getty Center in Los Angeles, which opens to the public on December 16th. He's also written a book about building the museum called Building the Getty. What were the buildings that you grew up around that made the biggest impression on you?
When I was very young, I lived in New Jersey, and I don't remember any works of architecture that were around the area where I grew up. I would see magazines, I read books, but it was all from things that I had read about that influenced me when I was very young.
So what you saw around you was suburban homes?
That's right.
Shopping centers?
Yeah, usual kind of suburbia.
Right. I believe one of your early commissions was building a house for your parents. Was that fraught with a lot of anxiety?
Well, in the beginning it was, because I had just begun my practice as an architect. It was one of the very first things that I was asked to do. And it was very courageous of them to ask me to do it. And they had lived in a three-story house and felt that as they were getting older, they wanted to live on what they thought was a ranch-type house, meaning one-story house, where they didn't have to walk up and down stairs. So they asked me to design a small house for them. I had the opportunity, while I was designing the house, to visit Falling Water, the great work by Frank Lloyd Wright in Bear Run, Pennsylvania. And this is the most magnificent house I've ever seen to this day. It's spectacular. And I thought, how can I do a house for my parents that ever can come close to this great work of Frank Lloyd Wright? But I was influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright and wanted to make spaces which move from the inside to the outside, that were, in his terms, part of an organic architecture that related man-made to the natural. And so I had brick walls which were in the living room that extended out into the garden past a glass wall. And the house was a wonderful house. They enjoyed it very much. Of course, my mother felt that there was too much art and not enough closets in terms of the design of the house. But other than that, you know, they really enjoyed it.
Richard Meyer, thank you so much for talking with us, and congratulations on the completion of the Getty.
Thank you very much.
Richard Meyer is the chief architect of the new Getty Center in Los Angeles. It opens to the public December 16th. His new book is called Building the Getty. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD by bass baritone Bryn Terfel. This is Fresh Air. The 32-year-old, 6'4", Welsh bass baritone Bryn Terfel has created a sensation in the opera world, especially in Mozart roles and most recently in Wagner. His latest album takes him into new recording territory, Baroque music. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of Terfel's first album of Handel arias. L'astuto cacciatore, quand'avido è di preda, l'astuto cacciatore.
Bryn Terfel is full of surprises. After his acclaimed Mozart, he recorded an album of Rodgers and Hammerstein songs, and he was just as convincing. Without the inflation or condescension opera singers usually bring to popular music. I saw him in person for the first time in September when he opened the Boston Symphony Orchestra season. He sang arias by four different Mozart characters in two different languages, Italian and German, not to mention a different body language for each character. I was impressed how effortlessly and completely he shifted from one character to the next. And with that rich, full, infinitely flexible voice, from darkest sub-basement to gleaming top, his singing is as natural, various, and uninhibited as his acting. His latest recording is devoted to a fairly neglected area of music, bass arias by Handel. In opera, basses are more likely to be villains or high priests or the hero's best friend than romantic leads. But Terfel's first Handel recording reveals what a wealth of marvels Handel handed over to some of his relatively minor players.
Revenge, 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 time of his cries. Revenge, thy Moses cries. Revenge, 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 thy Moses cries. Revenge, thy Moses cries. See the furies arise. See the snakes that they rear, how they hiss in their hair, and the sparkles that flash in their eyes, and the sparkles, the sparkles that flash in their eyes. Revenge, my boldest prize, revenge, my boldest prize. Revenge, 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 revenge. Furies arise, see the snakes that they rear, how they hiss in their hair, when the spark-
in their eyes.
That was from Handel's setting of John Dryden's Alexander's Feast, in which music itself has the power to stimulate Alexander the Great to wreak vengeance on the Persians. Rage and revenge are staples of the bass inventory. In O Ruddier Than the Cherry from Acis and Galatea, Handel turns this genre inside out. The monster Polyphemus is smitten with the lovely nymph Galatea. Handel uses dazzling coloratura to convey the comedy of the galumphing giant's clumsy attempt at romantic delicacy. Yet the beauty of the music also humanizes the monster. We're touched by him as we laugh at his absurdity.
Oh, ruddier than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry. Oh, ruddier than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry. Oh, nymph, oh, bright and moonshine light, like kidlings bright and merry. Oh, nymph, oh, bright and moonshine light, like kidlings bright and merry. Like kidlings bright and merry, like kidlings bright and merry. Oh, ruddier than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry. Oh, ruddier than the cherry, oh, sweeter than the berry. Oh, ruddier than the cherry, sweeter than the berry. Oh, nymph more bright than moonshine light, like kidlings blithe and merry. Blithe and merry. Oh, nymph more bright than moonshine light, like kidlings blithe and merry.
Veteran Handelian Sir Charles McCarris is the vivid conductor. Years ago, he conducted Tervel's very first professional opera appearance at the Welsh National Opera. Tervel cheats a little on this album. He sings several arias originally intended for tenors, altos, or castrati. But who could blame him? One of them, Ombra Mai Fu from Xerxes, is the most beautiful aria ever written to a tree. And in such familiar pieces as the three selections from Messiah, Tervel sings with an intensity of devotion you seldom hear in this repertoire, which makes this disc the perfect Christmas present. I know I can't stop listening to it. I can't remember a recording that's given me more pleasure all year.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new album of Handel arias sung by Bryn Tervel on the Deutsche Grammophon label. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced and directed today by Roberta Schurach. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Al Banks, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Katie Balser is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
It shall sound, and the dead shall be raised, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible. The trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be shall be changed, and we shall be changed.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.